This is the Tanana Yukon Historical Society meeting in the Chamber of Commerce at Basement Building, September the 22nd, 1966, our first meeting of the fall season. And our speaker for the evening will be Lou F. Joy. Okay.
I'm going to wipe some more of that off.
Mr. Lou F. Joy, you are now on the tape, and we would like to hear your life story. We'd like to know where you were born.
Well, as far as I can remember, I was born in Clark Mills, New York.
When?
April 25th, 1890.
And where did you... what's your mother and father's name?
Well, my mother's name was Freiberger. She, Ida Mae Freiberger. She, her father came from Germany, and I don't know where her mother came from. And my father, he was born on an island in the St. Lawrence River, which made him a Canadian, and afterward he was naturalized.
How many?
United States citizen.
Brothers and sisters?
I had one brother and two sisters.
One brother, and what were their names?
Well, my brother's name was Levant, and one sister, Pearl, she's deceased, and Mrs. Mary Dana, that just to be here, she's lives in Auburn now.
Seattle.
Your school childhood days were spent where?
Well, some in Skagway, Alaska, and some in...
Now, let's back up. We want to know, you're born in New York. We want to know, what induced you to come to Alaska?
Well, perhaps you'd better ask me when I came to Alaska first.
Leave him alone.
I came to Alaska with my parents when I was 8 years old in 1898 and landed at Skagway. And... my folks went into the Atlin country. We took the train on the White Pass in Yukon to Log Cabin, and then they necked a sled over to Atlin. And we stayed there a while. And I can't tell you the date, but my father was killed in a hunting accident in Skagway. And then mother took us kids back to Clinton, New York, where we went to school. I guess that I graduated there, come to think about it, and I never did go any farther. It's when I was working for the utilities here, we had a fellow from Ketchikan, Stewart, I think his name was, and he was investigating the utilities, so he asked Frank Mapleton what my background was. So Frank didn't know, so he asked me, and I said, I don't have any. Then... I think it was 1914, mother always wanted to come back, and when they passed the Congressional Act that authorized the building of the railroad, why then she thought that was a good time, so then we came to Fairbanks. We came down the river to Fort Gibbon at the time, and then come up to Tanana, and on the old Tanana, arrived here in August or July or August. It took us about a month from New York to here, where now we make it in a day or two. And things were pretty tough here then, I'll tell you. It was right after the miners' strike, and it was hard to get a job, and you had to work. It isn't like you do nowadays, you know, just go and draw your check. You had to work to keep the job. But we made it, and mother took up a homestead out here where Fort Wainwright is now, and we developed that. I worked at the sawmill and odd jobs, hunted moose for the market, and wasn't a law-abiding citizen then. And I don't know, we spent a few years out there. And then somewhere around 1920 or 22, I went to work for the NC Company as electrician. I learned the business in New York. First, I worked for the New York State Railways at Utica, New York, and Syracuse, New York, and then I worked for the International Harvester at Auburn, New York, and worked for Ford Motor Company in Detroit, and that finished out the electrical business pretty well as far as experience is concerned. So I had no trouble here, and I just stayed on with the NC until the city bought them out, and I think it was 50 or 60?
50.
And I went over with them and until I retired in, I think it was 57. And in the spare time, in my spare time, I served about 25 years or more on the school board. We had a one, well, not a one-story, but I guess it was two-story wood building where the main school is now, and one night it burned, and then we had to start all over again. And at that time, the city council built the schools, and they built the main school, so I never claimed any credit for that labyrinth up there. And soon we had to enlarge it, and got to go, so we're building a school for every year. But I've always been kind of proud of the Fairbanks school system, because kids would go out from here and go a grade or two ahead when they get out in the States. And we have always had a superior school system here. Nobody ever knocked a bond issue down. They wanted good schools and were willing to pay for it. That's all it takes. I think Fairbanks is to be commended on their school system. I don't want to pat my own back too much, but I think they are. You'll probably wonder why my father came to Alaska in the first place. He had a brother, Charles, that was, some reason or other, got to Skagway, and he was on the vigilante committee that went after Soapy Smith when Reed was shot. So my father went up there, and so he decided that we should all go to Alaska. I was 8 years old when we first landed in Skagway.
Do you remember what boat you came up on?
I think it was the first time was the old Alki. I know it took us quite a while. We broke down in Port Townsend and spent 4th of July there. I remember that. When we came in the second time, I forget what steamer we came up. I believe it was the Dolphin, though. It was a lot faster than the old Alki. But there's certainly a tremendous change since 1914 and the present time. We had the beginning of the Richardson Highway. And we were about 2 miles out or so. And in the summer and in the mud, we had to use boots and to get down through the road. It was so bad, and mosquito nets, because the mosquitoes were just terrible. They're nothing now like they used to be. We hunted up on Moose Creek one time, and we had to have a big mosquito tent to eat under. Boy, you just couldn't tie your sleeves down, tie your pants legs down. I never saw them so bad. But late years, there's none at all, comparatively. There used to be a lot of, it was hard to get meat in the early days. They used to drive cattle over the highway to Dawson, or to Whitehorse, I guess, or to, and then bring them down the cold storage boats, but there was lots of moose hunting, but apparently the moose population wasn't depleted too much, and of course I think I'll probably hear from this from some game conservationist, but I still believe where we used to go after cows because that was the best meat, I think that the herd increased better than it does now, where they don't allow many cows to be killed. I think, in fact, in all the states we've been in, they're in the deer population, they're letting them shoot females because, and they claim that the herd is increasing faster than ever did. I think that, well, in fact, I talked with a game warden the other day, and he said that the game commission wants to, but there's too much sentiment around town. They don't hardly dare do it, but I think they've got to come to it.
Puts new blood in the country, too. Describe a typical moose hunt for the market.
Well, the way we used to do it, I forgot to tell you that we stayed with old Harry Busby when we first came here, and then later he bought our mother's homestead on where Fort Wainwright is now. And old Harry and I, or he took me rather with him, we hunted over in the Wood River country. We'd float down. We know we didn't have any outboards in those days, so we'd float down the Tanana, down through, I think they call it Sawmill Slough, into the Salt Jacket, and up the Salt Jacket to Clear Creek. And then we went up to, pulled up Clear Creek until we came to the Bonnefield Trail. There used to be a roadhouse there. I forget the name of it now, or the fellow that run it. And then, this was about before the 20th September, just between the 1st and the 20th. Then we followed this old Bonnefield Trail over to Crooked Creek, and then we had a trail about 10 miles up toward Blair Lake, and we'd already cached grub there the spring before. And we'd cross all these streams, you know, on homemade bridges, and then we would kill the meat over there, and then when, after freeze-up, we'd come in, get horses and double-enders, and bring it in.
Oh, you hung it and froze it.
Well, we didn't hang it. We had a peculiar way of, we took poles and cribbed them up, you know, about this high, put the meat on there, flesh down. We didn't skin them. Then we put a couple of feet of spruce boughs on top of that to keep the sun out. We never had any spoil. But and we were, one year we were harassed by a bear. That was the only time. The bears usually hibernate before that. But that was a wonderful country for moose, and I guess it's better now because the Fish and Wildlife tell me that you can't get in there, and it's just, in fact, they want people to kill them in there, but they just can't get them out. But we had a trail a few miles long, and we go up and down this trail every morning. And one night the wind changed and started to snow, and if you know moose, why, they feed into the wind. And about 60 crossed that trail in one night. I never saw so many. And I guess there's more, way, way more now, because from what I hear, because nobody can hunt in there except in the winter.
What's the name of the little lake this side of Blair Lake, just over the hill? I flew over it last spring and counted 14 moose feeding in it.
Well, these two, we went up, we were close to these two hills that you can see from Salcha, and Clear Creek runs to the south of those. And we hunted just west of there.
And you didn't go get that meat until you could go in with horses.
And one year, I think it was 1916, we came over the Tanana on foot and got here in town, and we see a big black cloud over to the south, and it started to rain, thawed out, and we didn't get back for another month. That's the year all the boats here, the steamers, went into winter quarters down below Whitehorse, and then later thawed out, and they got up steam and went on up again. I believe it was 1916.
What did you sell that meat for a pound?
Oh, the usual price was 25 cents a pound for hindquarters and 20 cents for fronts. But of course, that's when the dollar was not devaluated. That was when it meant something to you. But in those days, you had to scheme around quite a little to get plenty to eat, and I always figured on getting enough to eat.
Now, you say you went over there about the 20th of September. There was no hunting for the market the remainder of the year?
Oh, sure, but then you couldn't get a... Conditions weren't as favorable as they were early, you know, after the snow came. Oh, yes. After you peddle that meat, why go and get some more? And all summer long, the fellows would pull up to Moose Creek here and hunt. In fact, My brother-in-law and I, Dana, were up cutting some house logs up far beyond where we are now. And it was a hot summer day and the mosquitoes were bad, and George decided he'd quit smoking cigarettes. And so it got him pretty bad. And old Jack Horn, you remember Jack Horn?
Yes.
He came down and going to town, so George asked him if he'd get him some cigarettes. And he said, oh, sure, when I come back. And he was poling, you know, we didn't have any motors. So that night we heard clump, clump, clump out on the bar, you know, we were camped right close to it. And naturally he thought it was Jack coming up, so he got up and here it was a moose out on the bar. So he called me to shoot him, and so we shot him and dressed him, brought him to town, sold him. So he got his cigarettes.
Were you here for the fire, the big fire in Permix?
Oh, yes.
Take us through that. Where did it start and how?
Well, I don't know. I was living out in the country. I was a foreigner. I wasn't here in town. But I just couldn't tell you much about it. I know that it was a pretty near wiped the town out. And going back to this Harry Busby, he was one of the pioneer farmers in this country, you know. He lived up there, well, I don't know where you can't describe it now because the army installation's there, but he had a wonderful garden and he raised hay, and I forget whether he had any stock or whether he just sold his hay, but he was really one of the pioneer farmers of this area.
Did he help start the flour mill over by the depot?
I don't know about... I couldn't tell you about that. I used to work there, you know. I helped run the mill over there for...
Well, tell us about it.
Well, it was... they certainly put up a wonderful little mill there, and... If it wasn't for quite a lot of propaganda around by the merchants, it would have gone over fine. In fact, it did go over well. It made wonderful flour, and it demonstrated that you can raise hard wheat here without any trouble, and I don't ever remember them having a failure in the wheat crop. Oh, we had a swell mill there. They had made graham flour, white flour, and it was nearly automatic. I was doing the firing and roustabout work, and Charlie Peterson, that used to be in the machine shop, he was quite a little genius, you know, and he rigged up an automatic water pump that on the engine. That as the engine worked, it put water into the boiler, and you could just about set that so you never had to put any water in the boiler all day long. Just stoke it with wood. It was really quite a deal, but there was quite a little opposition here. There always has been for outside products, you know. A lot of people are too prone to find fault with products or that are grown or produced in Alaska, and that's one thing that's been the trouble with our country here. The miners, they would mine, you know, work day and night, and then take their poke of gold and go outside and spend it instead of spend it here. So, the country suffers.
Well, you had enough farmers around here raising wheat to maintain that mill.
Yeah, they, of course, this was due a lot, you know, to the efforts of George Gasser. He was a wonder when it came to things like that, and they had several varieties of wheat, and I forget the name of this one. It was a hard wheat, but it was almost infallible in this climate. Made good flour. I don't know what happened to the mill. It burned suddenly when...
It burned after I came here in 37. Yeah.
I don't know what the circumstances were. We took up a homestead. That mother took up this one that Busby bought, and then we took up one where we are now. We didn't really want to go farming, but we wanted to buy the fellow they called the Persian up where Art Brown's place is now. And by some hook or crook, he got title to that land, and so the road was passable up that far. So we wanted a place for our boat. I'd got a motor by that time, and so I went up to the land office, and my old friend Tom Hunt was up there, and so he looked it over, and he says, Lou, what do you want to buy a place for? He says, here's 600 feet of riverfront. He says, it's going begging up there. He says, won't you take up a homestead? I says, what do I want a homestead? Working every day, and I never did believe in holding two jobs. I never thought much of this moonlighting deal. So he says, you better go back up and take a look at it. So we did, and it looked fine, all covered with brush. And so went back up, and I told him, well, I think we should take a 40. And he says, no, don't take a 40. He says, take all you can. He says, you can always relinquish, but he says, you can't always get more when you want it. So we did, and of course it was during the war, and it's hard to get bulldozers, and you had to get an eighth of it cleared. But we finally did, after various troubles and vicissitudes, we got title to it, and we've always been glad we did. Built a home out there. Then after that, we had to fight with the Territorial Board of Road Commissioners to get the road fixed, and finally the territory went out of business and the state built it, but we finally got it built.
Were you there first, or Harry Badger?
Oh, Badger was there years and years ago. In fact, I cut wood with Harry one winter up there. You remember the Independent Lumber Company used to have a rig that sawed 16-foot logs up into 16 or to 4-foot lengths, and then they had a couple of splitters that split it. And they were supplying wood to the NC Company. You remember they used to buy, I don't know, probably they were out of business when you came.
Their mill site was still there.
Yeah, well, they used to burn wood in the early days in their boilers. During the big fire, though, they used bacon to get steam up. They had to have the steam. But anyway, I spent one winter up there with Harry. We cut wood and yarded it out on the bank and then drove it down in the spring. And the independent mill bought it all and sold it to the NC Company.
You sold to the mill sold to the NC. Tell us about the NC's boiler room and wood yard and the car that went out there.
Well, up on Barnett Street, I would say up where the school is now, up near Airport Road, is where they had their wood yard. And during the winter, you know, I don't know whether you know the policy of the NC in the early days. They'd give you anything you wanted and rely on, if it was a miner, rely on his cleanup in the spring. And if he didn't make it, well, the chances are that he would go and cut wood for him the next winter. So that's, there was nothing else to burn except wood. So everybody was hauling wood, and it was kind of peculiar, you know, to see these fellas with four-horse teams come in with a big jag of wood, you know, and when they get outside, within a half a mile or so, you'd see them stop, and the driver would get out with a stick of wood, and he'd go and pound the ends of it up so it'd measure a little more. And they had cars that would hold two cords of wood, and they'd run them up, and fellas would load them. Then they had a steam winch and a cable, and they'd pull them into the powerhouse. And I think they had four boilers to start. And when I went to work for them, they were still burning wood. And finally, they got two new boilers, and when the Healy River Coal Company opened up, and they started burning coal. And when I first went there to work for them as electrician, I did mostly custom work outside for them, but we did work in the powerhouse too, and they had a peculiar system. They had a pretty good sized engine. They were Corliss engines, and they had the Edison three-wire system, 110, 220 DC. And they would have this one engine and two generators sitting out here and two belts, one to one and one to the other, so that they run on the same engine. And they had two or three sets of these generators. And if they wanted to shut down one and put on a bigger one, they'd have to have the power off a little while. So I knew very well that wasn't necessary, but nobody had ever tried to parallel them, so that was one of my jobs. We sure had them parallel, so we had no more trouble. And they used to have a night circuit and a day circuit. They had the most wonderful system that you ever saw, you know. You just couldn't believe it until you saw it.
Is this Bill Hunter's ingenuity?
No, that was Bill and I straightened it out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. I forget to, let's see, what was his name now? Before Bill Hunter.
Did you get luck that took care of that for a while?
Well,
he was there when the beacon was burned.
Yeah.
Yeah, what year was that, 1911?
See, I couldn't tell you.
He didn't tell us until 1914.
Then, of course, afterward, they decided to change over to alternating current, and then we had to switch the whole town over, and that was quite a deal.
That's why I saw all the DC motors over the DC warehouse.
And then the telephone went through the same growing pains. They had the old magnetophone, you know, And then we changed to the common battery, and then we changed to the same that we got now. And I helped with that, and Jess and Bill. And
wasn't there a horse involved in this hauling the wood from the wood yard down to the firehouse?
Yeah, I guess they did, because it was too far to string out a cable. It was half a mile or so. I think they had a team of horses that did nothing but that. But they left them down on the siding, then they hauled them in with a cable.
Didn't they have a track? They ran a car up there?
Oh, yeah. Small railroad track. About a 30-pound rail or something like that. But boy, they used to use an awful lot of wood.
When did George Gasser come to this town? I know he was at Rampart first, but I don't know.
Well, I couldn't tell you just when, but I know he was at Rampart for quite a while. But he really was a great asset to this area. Of course, late years, I might be a little prejudiced, but we haven't had much success from the experimental farm. More like they supply the university with what they raise, and it's like the deal down in Arkansas where we live. You know, Faubus has these prison farms where they see how much they can grow and how much money they can make, and it's the same way out here, has been. See, by the paper now, they're transferring it to the university. But Gasser did an awful lot of research work, and he really developed some great hybrids in a lot of fields. But this wheat that they had, this hard wheat for the mill, it was, I never did hear of a crop failure on the wheat.
Why does it not market?
What's that?
Why does that not market?
Well, there were certain influences here in town that were working against it.
Didn't Paul Bloom resurrect it here when he was back this year?
Yeah, I see where he did, yes.
I know, the first year we were in town, we tried to get that flower, and there was only very little available.
Well, the first, I worked there, I think, a couple of years, and well, you had plenty then. But it was really a superior flower.
Yeah, well, everybody was trying to get it, I know.
And the old bakery tried that, people on Third Avenue there for a while.
Yeah, that's right. Just like when they built the brewery here, you know. Bill Hunter and I used to make quite a few trips over there to the brewery, and by golly, the beer was really good over there, but when you get over here, Lathrop and his gang, they, I don't know, they left it too long in the keg or something, and it wouldn't be so good, but if you got it at the source, it was really, really good beer.
Yeah, he was interested in that Olympia beer.
Yeah. Oh, that's so far away, you know, that I can't hardly remember. That's pretty near 52 years ago.
What? Well, you found a young lady somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Tell us about her. What was her name?
Well, I was chasing around Auburn, New York with her. And
oh, New York girl.
Yeah, so she decided she'd like to come to Alaska if we got married.
She put the B on you,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, yeah. So we...
What was her name?
Well, her name was Clark at that time.
Clark? Miss Clark.
And we had four children there, all living in Alaska yet.
And their names?
Well, there's Bill and Ruth and Lois and Bob. And I've always been kind of proud of Bill, you know. He's worked around now till he's gotten my job with the utilities, the job I used to have.
Well, it's an achievement to have the entire family remain in Alaska nowadays.
Yeah. Well, we probably would still be staying here winters, but old Doc Haglin told her that she shouldn't stay in Alaska during the winters, that they're too long and cold for her. She has a heart trouble, so. The last 5 or 6 years, we've been spending our winters in Arkansas, and we got so we're accepted by the hillbillies now, which is quite a feat, and we're just, they say we're one of them. But we like it down there. It's, you have the four seasons, and we've never spent a summer. I'm afraid it'd be too warm for us.
Now you're leaving out a very interesting story, Lou, about your radio work in the miners.
Oh, I got the bee one time, and you remember John Stump?
Oh, yes, my neighbor.
Well, I took code practice from Johnny, and oh, I got so I could take 15, 20 words a minute, and so then I got a license. And then I got a Class A license for phone, and the Alaska Communication System here, they were very, very lenient in their exams, especially for the outlying districts, because there was no communications at all, and if a fellow just said that he would study, they'd give him a license, and he'd put in a phone, you know, and then he'd communicate with me, and I used to be on every night. In fact, the airlines, they all would call me up for weather from Chicken or Fort Yukon or around Manly Hot Springs.
Dubin? Dubin?
Sam Dubin?
Yeah.
Weissman.
And then we had a Corporal Kirk, I believe, up at
Old Crow.
Used to talk with him. And in fact, he called me up one night, and he didn't have phone. He called me up on code, and he wanted to know about some big fight here in the United States. I guess he had some money up on it. And I happened to know, I'd read about it. So I gave him the information. Then finally, due to the fact that I was employed by the NC, Sampson Hardware figured that I was giving the NC more business than I was Sampson Hardware from these outlying places. Oh. So somebody made a complaint, and the FCC had an examiner in here. And so the Alaska Miners Association took it up then and says, why not have a hearing and have Lou up there? So they did. So they had quite a lot of witnesses. The technical charge against me was communicating with a commercial station, which you weren't supposed to do, you see. So finally the examiner, after he'd heard the evidence, he says, did you ever consider taking out a commercial license? And I said, well, I no, because I says it's against your regulations to have two in the same community. He says, you know, if I was you, I'd apply for one. So I did, and shortly I got one. The only qualification was that I could only communicate when this station were off the air, you see. Well, shortly after that, they went to 24-hour service, so it helped everybody. But I got a letter from the commissioner in Washington and said as far as they were concerned, the incident was closed. So the examiner said he didn't see where I played any favorites. All I did was they tell me who they wanted me to give the message to, and I gave it to them.
Well, I couldn't help but bring this up while it's your story, Lou, but that's about when I came into the picture. And wherever the miners were, I'd visit around the country. I could always talk to you at night. And I was up on the No Grub one time, and I heard Chicken calling for me, and you told him I was up at No Grub and that you was going to call him pretty soon, and then they could talk to me through you. But the one incident that I want to hear you tell these people is the Johnsons up in the Good Pasture. And when she bought 40 pounds of carrot seed.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I remember talking to them all right, but...
Don't you remember when she sent down a grocery list to you and you had 40 pounds of carrot seed and you couldn't imagine why anybody in the world would want 40 pounds of carrot seed, and it was parrot for her paw parrot.
I don't remember that one.
Well, I do.
But old Ed Krager up there, he was a card at No Grub. He'd get on the air and he would just, well, everybody in the country listened to him.
Yeah, and he had a neighbor that he wasn't too friendly with, and you and Ed would get on code, and the neighbor couldn't understand it. Then he was mad.
But the ham radio sure was a wonderful thing here in the early days for the miners and the community, you know, the bush communities, because they had no other means of communication.
Who was the lady that you used to talk to so much? I think they all know her. I can't think of her name.
Mrs. Sam Dubin?
No,
Wiseman?
No.
Over in the
40
mile?
No,
it was up around the
Johnsons. Oh, yeah. I can't tell your name, though.
She lives here in town.
Yeah. Mrs. King, wasn't it?
Lila
King.
That's right.
Did McKinnon bring coal in here before Camp Rafik did, before the railroad got in here?
Boy, I just couldn't say.
I came down the river with McKinnon, and he talked about starting coal. I didn't pay much attention to it.
No, I couldn't say.
Coal.
Well, you certainly dealt these people a wonderful service, because every evening about 6:30, Lou would start calling, and he'd start at No Grub, Good Pasture, in the Chicken Country, and Circle, and Eagle, and Wiseman, Fort Yukon, and down to Manly Hot Springs, and ended up with Earl Pilgrim at Stampede.
Were you here when the aviation started, Lou?
Oh, yes.
And you must have known all the...
Oh, yeah, because all the pilots just phoned me up for... How's the weather over Chicken this morning? Well, if they'd let me know the night before, I would make a date and get it for them. And the thing that always amazed me was these pilots or the businessmen here in town would never question you, you know. They would never doubt your word. And it's quite a serious matter when you're flying a plane. The weather, you know, and but they never doubted it. Even Pan Am called me up once or twice to get the weather at Old Crow, because they didn't have anybody up there. They were making some kind of a flight, you know.
Who'd you take your first airplane ride with?
Oh, let's see now. Probably it was Frank Pollock. I don't know now.
You remember the Black Wolf Squadron? Were you here when the
first plane launched? Oh, yeah. I was cutting wood with Harry Badger that winter, and we saw them from up his place.
And two Blackbirds
coming from Dawson. Four birds.
I was in the
Black
Vermilion. I was there when they landed.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Was Ileson the first? He made the first trip, mail trip that I was on.
Yeah, I think he did.
I wasn't here last year. I was the year before, I think.
Yeah, he was quite a character. He was teaching in the school, you know, and nobody knew he was a flyer. So once and then suddenly he got a plane and started flying.
Oh, he was a school teacher here in the beginning.
Sure.
Huh? Was that handsome you're talking about?
Eielson.
Eielson.
Ben Eielson.
Ben Eielson.
You know, it's a small country down in Arkansas. We have a friend that he used to be in the North Country, Montana, and up through there. And he knew the Eielson family very well, see. So, gosh, when he found out that I was from Alaska, boy, we had to know all about Ben, because he was a great friend of the family down there.
Could the pioneers not do something to get the Eielson Memorial back to where it belonged at Eielson Gate? Tourists this year especially were looking for that.
Did you ever run dogs? I didn't hear you say a word about dogs.
Well, I'll tell you, boy, that's a closed subject. We had a dog team and hauled meat with them. And, you know, they'd be going along and so tired they couldn't raise one foot above another. And a rabbit would go through, and boy, you couldn't hold them with a brake. And then these sloughs, like Saltchucket Slough, and, you know, steep banks, you'd be pushing, you'd be the biggest dog of all, and they'd just get up to the top and just balanced over it. Then they'd turn around, stop, turn around, look at you. You couldn't get the whip out or nothing, and you'd have to push the sled over. I got enough of dogs.
You mean they'd find a fire hydrant right there and stop? That's what mine all did.
Boy, I hauled meat with dogs for quite a while. Oh, I did pretty near everything here. One year I worked at the Independent Lumber on the cutoff saw, and you had to, the slabs kept coming, so you had to cut them off and get them out of the way. You just had to work.
Those were floated down La Chena?
Yeah.
Did they also float them down File Driver and into the Chena?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you know, in the early days, they tried to put a weir dam out at the head of the Pile Driver Slough to make more water in here so the steamboats could get up. And then now later, they tried to shut off all the water up there so that there wouldn't be the water here.
Isn't that the way Pile Driver Slough got its name?
Sure. Yeah, they tried to divert the water into the Chena.
What's the most spectacular ice breakup you've seen here in Fairbanks?
Oh boy, I just couldn't tell you. I don't know. We had some dandies here years ago, but I couldn't tell you when.
Currently,
I'm
17, and they just missed me off the bridge.
Yeah?
And Dr. Johnson was on that bridge and dedicated it to she and Nora Lewis. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'd like some more highlights of something very interesting that happened, something spectacular. Good hunting story.
Well, so you know, the first time I went hunting over in the Wood River country with the dog teams, we went up the river, we went over the Bonnefield Trail to Wood River, and then up the river to a little cabin, half underground and half above, they called Cottonwood Cabin. So we went back, or I did, it was two or three feet of snow, and I hadn't had much experience hunting moose, so a fellow told me, he says, if you see one back of the willows or anything, he says, just shoot the gun and he'll step out. You know, and so, boy, I kept going till I see this big guy get up back the willows, and I couldn't, there was too many willows for me to shoot, so I shot the gun. My gosh, he just stepped out a length or two right in plain view. So, this was a new gun. I'd never zeroed it in or shot. We didn't have any scopes those days. So, shot at him, and I wounded him all right, but I didn't kill him. And he'd go every so far and lay down. And, of course, I didn't have sense enough then to wait a while and let him stiffen up, you know. And so I kept shooting at him, and kept shooting at him, and missing him all the time. And I guess I shot up near a box of ammunition. Finally, he lay down and couldn't get up anymore, and then I took a few shots shooting at his head, and I found that my front sight was the wrong sight, and I was shooting too high. But I shot pretty near a box of ammunition, but I got him, finally. And when he brought him into town, I weighed him here at the NC, and the quarters went over 250 apiece, so, you know, he was a big one. The game wardens were pretty good at that in those days. We used to take the meat into the cabin and thaw it and skin it, because it's 10% hide, and that's a lot of pounds, you know, when you're mushing dogs. So we had a quarter hanging in there, and we were out somewhere, and by golly, we come back that evening, and here was a note from Andy Hoy. He used to be a game warden here in the early days, and he said he'd been in and had lunch with us. He never made any mention of the moose hanging there. Duck hunting in the spring, they would, the game wardens would go over across the river until about the first week in May. Then they came back, and they'd put a notice in the paper that it was illegal to shoot ducks or geese, and you better not be caught with one after that. But previous to that, it was all right. They had pretty good.
Weren't they territorial game wardens?
Gosh, I don't know. All I know is they were game wardens. But they were cooperative.
Why? Because they knew you needed the meat.
Yeah. I remember Sam White, when he was game warden, he, you know, the kids would all go out quite close to town and shoot ducks, you know, in the evening, and it kind of made it bad for Sam, because people would holler and says, what's all this shooting in here? Why are you? Aren't you on the job? So my kids were among them. So I told him, I said, why don't you get away from town where everybody can't hear you shoot? I said, it makes it bad for the fellows. So they did. And old Sam come around and said he appreciated that.
How many years did you hand out diplomas at this school on Cushman Street?
Well, I don't know, a lot of them. You know, one of the highlights, you might say, is in later years, I handed out diplomas to the children of people I'd handed them out earlier to. Two or three instances.
That's what I wanted you to say.
Weren't you in the legislature too? Sold it. How much did get for geese and ducks?
Oh, they didn't sell them.
Well, Johnny Buckethead said he used to buy them.
Well, he was a better shot than I.
Weren't you several years in the legislature? Seven,
I spent one session, 47.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I sat across the aisle from Bill Egan. His main thought in life then was to get a bounty on eagles. He finally got it through, and then the Congress put an end to that. It was the national bird. Well, I'll tell you something. Everybody ought to try to go to the legislature once in their life to see what makes it tick, because you'd never believe it.
I've sat through several sessions. I never wanted to go. I audited several sessions.
All the big, the way we found it, the big decisions were made over in the
bubble room at night, and then the next day they passed it.
I guess it's still that way. Well, if you have no more, Lou?
No, I think that's about
Dallas.
How many grandchildren have you?
Let's see.
Stop and count mine, too.
How many is it?
Eight.
Eight?
I was waiting for him to ask. Each of the children have two.
Very fine. Very fine.
No thanks.
Please.
Mr. Cassidy, how would it be to have Mrs. Joy Watson?
Oh, no.
Say a few words on that.
I'd rather not.
Yes. Well, that will conclude the speak by Mr. Lou Joy for this evening.